So, we'll take some questions from the floor. If you want to ask a question, just pop up your hand and I'll get to everyone. We'll start with you, sir. You were first.
The motivation to what you've been doing and all the thing is your Christian faith. Can you talk about that a bit and how you became a Christian and how you came so committed to the cause that you're doing now?
So my father died when I was 10, and my sister, who was 4 years older, my father was a committed Christian. My sister, who was 4 years older, had a friend around one night, and they were talking about the return of the Lord, and I didn't really know what this phrase, the return of the Lord, meant. And they explained how I thought that Jesus would come back, sort everything out, and then go away again, and it would all collapse. And I couldn't quite see what was so special about the return of the Lord. And they explained how that basically through the cross, God had given us the opportunity to have eternal relationship with him, and explained that my father was there with God in heaven. At the age of 10, having lost my father 6 months previously, that was very big to me. And that night I gave my heart, as we say, to the Lord. But to be fair, and to be honest, it made no difference to my life. I carried on living my life as I had been the day before. And then when I was 19, and this is just a little bit of to woo your hearts, I was in a church in Dumfries, because I was actually born in Kilmarnock, although I don't have any of the accent, but I was in, I think it was Bethany Hall in Dumfries, where there was a man speaking, whose name has just escaped me, and I was staying with my grandmother, and she said, this man will probably speak in the morning breaking a bread, and he's spent half his life so far, Sammy was his name, half his life so far in prison. He got up and he spoke from John chapter 1, and as I looked at this man, I saw, you have got the reality of living a Christian faith. I know the academics. I do not have the reality. And at that point, I thought, I need to find the reality. So I would say that I started to attempt to become a disciple of Jesus Christ when I was 19. What's made me like I am? Ask Stephanie. She doesn't get it either. Stephanie read my script, and she thought, I do not get why it is what it is. I can't believe one person can make so many mistakes. And so Stephanie and Richard came out and stayed with me in Nairobi. And at the end of 4 days of visiting what we do at the charity, visiting what we do at the business, she realized, oh, one man can make that many mistakes. I do not know what has driven me to be the person that I am. But I am what I am. And in a sense, Stephanie was wanting me to say, you know, there'd been writing on the ceiling, or, you know, there was a plane crash and I was the only survivor, and the word Kenya came into my head just as I was about to drown, and then I was saved, and so I went to Kenya. I don't know what it is. I'm just...
So you still have a committed Christian faith?
Oh, that's what drives me every day. I made good money as a quantity surveyor. Counting bricks is quite profitable. And if I'd wanted an easy life with material comfort, I would have stayed being a freelance QS. It was sitting in that tin shed. And I think, and I touched on it in the book, it is the injustice. We did the child sponsorship thing. We sponsored a young girl, Mujer, in Rwanda. And we lost touch with her for those 2 years when the atrocities took place. And Vicky, our daughter, was the same age as Mujer. And I thought, what has Mujer done to deserve to live through that? Yeah. Absolutely nothing. What has my daughter done to deserve a free education, a good structured home, knowing that the dinner is on the table every night, loving, comforting parents? Nothing. Therefore, how much responsibility do I have as a child of God to be a good steward of what is entrusted? And that's, I'm not talking about money, although money is a part of that. I'm talking about time, I'm talking about ideas, I'm talking about making a difference.
And the lady behind you, yes,
hello.
Hi.
My name's Elspeth. I worked in healthcare and supporting charities as well in Nigeria for 5 years. But actually, my question, my first question, I'll come back probably to ask you another, is what can Scotland learn from your Kenyan experience? I noticed you were sponsoring 16 trainees, apprentices. What can Scotland learn in the context of food banks and impoverishment and lack of building work skills?
So part of the reason, again, for writing this book is to challenge the people that are decision makers, whether that be in business, whether that be in local government, whether that be in whatever environment you find. Because actually, and let's not get into a political debate of socialism and capitalism, which I would do, but obviously would divide the room. But if you're a decision maker, you have a responsibility of the impact of your decisions. And therefore, you know, one of the challenges that I see is the businesses that are making huge amounts of money and paying their workers £2 a day to stitch labels in jeans to send to Europe. Now, how on earth can that be just? And I sincerely hope, coming back to your question, that no Christian is involved in that, but maybe they are. But as a Christian, given the responsibility that we have to think about the implications of every decision that we make, even to what we pay a taxi driver, even to how we treat anybody that is connected to us, whether that be financially or purely in respect. I worked for a company called Bovis as a trainee. I don't think they're around now. But every 3 months you had an interview. And the last question in the interview was, there was a big hierarchy in Bovis, and you had to learn who each person was in the directorship. And so it got to my last question, and the interviewer said to me, who's Chris Dick? I said, I don't know. He goes, but you knew this would be the last question, that you'd be asked the company structure. So I said, yes. So he said, so why don't you know the answer? I said, why do I need to know the answer? He said, because when you meet Chris Dick in the corridor, you need to treat him with respect. And I said, when I meet everybody in the corridor, I treat them with respect. The next 3 months came, and it came to the last question in the interview, a different interviewer, but he's got my notes. And he looks at the last question, and he goes, I've got a last question for you. I said, yes. He said, but you don't know the answer, do you? So I said, no. He closed the folder and said, off you go. Respect. Do we really believe that we are all equal? Because that's how God made us. God made us all equal. God made us who we are, and we develop who we are, possibly for good, possibly for bad. Do we genuinely believe that we are all equal, that the cleaner should be treated with just as much respect as the CEO? Where I stay in Nairobi, we have an apartment in a complex. My son has been studying at university. We have a guard on the gate. He cooked Christmas dinner and went down and ate it with him. He didn't just take a plate of food and say, Happy Christmas. He went down, and I've got to tell you, I was a little bit proud. Because what he was saying is, we will eat Christmas dinner together. And you will eat the same as I am going to eat. That's what being equal, that's what having respect is about, in my view. And therefore treating others, as we read in Philippians, better than yourselves, means exactly, think of the consequences and the impact of what we do. Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question?
Tentatively, I mean, fundamentally, yes. It's really about, there is construction going on in Scotland, there are businesses in electronics and all sorts of other industries. I don't know how we incentivise apprenticeships.
So my answer to your question is, for all I empathise with that, if that's not the area that you're in, my attitude is I can't do anything about it. It happens to be I'm in construction. So I can structure apprenticeships and I can pay people fairer. Whatever your area is, it's fine to have an empathy with other challenges. That's more in the political arena. Mm. But where do you have influence? Mm-hmm. Where can you change people's thinking? Where can you create training or value add to a person that you're associated with? Mm.
I think you met Brennan as a lady there, and then there's a gentleman there. Oh, it's all going very well.
Okay. 52 years ago, I was sleeping out in London, and the thing about dignity really strikes me, because there were charities that tried to help me, but they treated me as if I was a problem. So I was not an individual. I didn't have a name, I didn't have a background, I didn't have a future, even ambitions, as far as the charities were concerned. Does this make sense? And, you know, since then, I've made my mission that, you know, whatever you're doing, it is the dignity of the human being that should be at the core of that. So in answer to your question, I think, in Scotland, I was in South Easter House a few years ago and asked this room of people, can anyone sum up what life is like in South Easter House? This woman, she was an elderly stateswoman. She said, well, son, see if you're wanting a suntan or a criminal lawyer. Fucking brilliant place to live. See if you want to buy a banana, you go get on a bus and go down the road. And I thought that was a brilliant encapsulation of what the market delivered to Easter House. Now, the reason I mentioned that is that there's a growth in social enterprises in Scotland. AXA Business Insurance did this massive research recently, and it showed that in Scotland, young people in particular, want to go and to do something that's purposeful, that makes a difference to the world around them. They're less driven by money and more driven by purpose. London was at the other end of the scale. Money was much higher up the scale. So I think what you're doing is amazing. And I'm looking forward to reading the book. But at the heart of it is dignity. Because if you do things for people, if you present something to people as a charitable offering, it doesn't raise them up. It doesn't make them feel that they have got, you know, the kind of human spirit that you're talking about. So we need to shift the model. And apprenticeships are available, and it's up to the government. And I think the government have said if you're doing a build, you need a certain proportion of apprenticeships. So it is possible to build it in to the fabric of business policy.
You're going to be my next person to interview. But what I'm wondering now is, do you have a question?
It's about how do we, you know, move the private sector towards what you're doing, so that we don't have different sectors, so that we have, you know, a single sector which, you know, grows economies but gives people dignity and work.
So I think what the question you're asking is almost an ideal model.
Yeah.
I said that I didn't want to get into politics.
Yeah.
Because that will challenge, and now you're all looking at me and thinking, what's he going to say next? I would say that as a young person, I was a socialist. I would say now I'm a capitalist with a socialist mindset.
Absolutely.
So I see that the business has an opportunity to create training, to create jobs, and to pay people properly. And it's a responsibility, as I think I've already said, for the business owners to recognise their social responsibility. CSR, you know, is a sort of, it's always been there, and I think there is an element of it starting to grow. And that's good, but it needs to be serious. And the difference, you really wanted to drag me into politics, but the difference business can make at grassroots level rather than policy level, for me, is where the impact can be. That's all I'll say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've got three more questions. First of all, totally not about your book, but it's about Africa, where I grew up. Yesterday I learned about an Englishman who lives in the Cape Flats in Cape Town, which is a predominant... Do you know South Africa?
Very little.
It's a predominantly mixed race area, which is full of slum dwellings. There is a lot of drug use and violence. And when he was 23, as a born-again Christian, he'd gone to South Africa to some reason, and then felt he needed to go back, and he gave up whatever else he was doing in London, and just went in faith. 10 years later, he's still there, and he's just released a book called No Neutral Territory. And I just wondered, first of all, if you have any, well, you said you don't have much knowledge of South Africa, but I wondered if you had anything going on there in South Africa. And I also wondered if there might be something, I don't even know this man, I'm just speaking from intuition or something, whether you might be able in some way to help that scenario. That was the one thing. I also wanted to mention trees. You said in Kenya they want to earn their own money, they want to create their own income, they want to build their own buildings, but you said they don't want to plant trees, which is what the donors want them to do.
No.
And I just wondered if you agree with planting trees.
No, I was just giving that as an obscure example. A donor might say, I want you to plant a tree, and they want to do something different. I wasn't actually going to do anything.
Okay.
And I can't
think of
it. Okay, so the first question that you've asked is, it's taken me 19 years to develop a trustworthy network in Kenya that we fully trust, that is fully shares the same ethics and morals as we do. I'm 58 now, and I think for all I still have ideas, I think I'm running out of time to start another 18-year cycle. That's not to say that God couldn't intervene and make that cycle quicker, but I actually think that I will continue to concentrate in Kenya. But I'm extremely open and happy, and again, if you go to the book, so buy a copy of the book and give it to you. At the back is my email address, and the reason that I did that was so that I'm touchable. I'm not some far away, distant white author that sits, you know, in my attic thinking of stories and writing books. But there's my email address, so that I can share my experiences of how it's happened in Kenya. I was once invited to a group of Nigerian and Ghanaians, and they said, how would you handle corruption in Nigeria? I said, I haven't got a clue. Nigeria, it scares me to go to Nigeria. I hear you even have to bribe the taxi driver to when you come out the airport. I wouldn't have a clue. All I can tell you is how God has worked through my experience and circles in Kenya. And if any of that is helps in your environment, then fine. And I can then talk about, you know, perseverance and cash flow and all the different challenges. You know, there is no formula that business will work. Go to any business school, university, whatever, there is no set formula. You do this and it will work. Because another story in the book, it's a very good book, by the way, another story in the book of where we bought property and lost money, about £100,000. If we'd done it 10 years later, it could have been, what a phenomenal success. But it didn't. It happened at the end of the 90s when interest rates trebled and property prices dropped, and it was a disaster. That's why there is no formula to business. And you've got to be moving the whole time and thinking about, what does the market want? What does this market want right now? In Nairobi, it's changing all the time. There's probably an oversupply of office space right now, but there's an undersupply of student accommodation. So what worked yesterday isn't necessarily going to work tomorrow, and certainly not in a different place. But I can certainly give advice or experience of my story.
Okay, thank you. Oh, this young man in there, that not quite as young man.
So mine's a bit more technical. You're talking about, you've built like a trusted network of over the last 19 years. How did you do that? And what were some of the challenges that you faced around kind of recruiting contractors? And I'm really interested in your apprenticeship program. How do you recruit your young people? And thirdly, how many different experiences of the financial model of your company have you gone through to come out? I looked at the Hand in Hand website and you've got a 40-40-20 structure. How did you agree to to come to that model, and how does that limit you from finding kind of investors that you want to share? How do you find the investors mostly that want to share the values that you're pushing in?
Wow.
How do you find your trusted people? How do you find the best people to get apprenticeships? How did you work out your financial model, and how did you find your investors? On your marks, get set.
So trusted partners has really been trial and error, and there have been people that we have found not to be trustworthy, and fortunately they haven't done us too much damage. But now, having done what we've done for as long as we've done, basically if people are out to get you, it doesn't necessarily take that long for it to surface. So that cycle doesn't need to be so huge, but certainly we've made our mistakes in people that we've worked with. But now we have a trusted team of architects, quantity surveyors, structural engineers, mechanical and electrical engineers, who, as I've already said, share our ethics and would work to the standards that we want to work to. For apprentices, we have an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, with the Anglican Construction School in Nairobi. So we go to them and we say, we've got a project, it's at the stage for plumbers and electricians. Have you got any people looking for placements? For usually they're for 3 months. So we take the students from the construction school. And the beauty of that is that we then get a report back afterwards to find out if they actually have done plumbing and electrical work and not just been sweeping up or making tea or whatever. So there is an accountability. And we then attempt to help to get them work thereafter. However, if you think about it hard enough, the good ones actually get employed by the people they've done the placements with, and the bad ones are the ones that we're looking to get jobs for. Mm-hmm. So that creates its own challenge. And then,
the financial
model.
The investors, yeah.
So the 40-40-20 model you're referring to is, so hand in hand commit to giving 40% of our profits to charitable work, in the main Hand in Hand Foundation, but it's not exclusive. 40% is reinvested in the country, well originally we said the country we make it in, but we only work in Kenya now, so it's committed to be reinvested in business in Kenya, and 20% is for our shareholders. How did we arrive at that? One day a board director said, it's all very well you talking about giving money to charity, but you never really committed to a figure. And so that day we committed to 40-40-20, and we put it on our website for that very reason, that it is now public and we are accountable for that. And therefore I think the next question you're asking is, how does that affect the investment that we get? Because are they prepared to buy into the 40-40-20 model? Well, the 40-40-20 model actually has nothing to do with our investors, because it's the profit that Hand in Hand make. So we charge fees for the work that we do. We obviously have costs associated with the fees that we charge, and we make a margin. And out of that margin, we have the 40-40-20 model. But that doesn't make us more expensive.
No, I was more referring to the ethics of the investors that you find. You've got the ethics going downwards to a network of contractors. How does the ethics and value of Hand in Hand find the investors? The financial model of the investors was a separate question.
Right.
So have you found that the ethics of what Hand in Hand are about draw attractions from particular investors that will repeat, or how does the investment network kind of...
So I wrote a book in order to expose me to investors who would go, wow. Because I think there are lots of people out there, out wherever, who want to do good with their money and they don't know who to trust. And they hear about Grant Smith and they think, well, you know, there must be a scam going on here somewhere, it can't be that good. So go to Stephanie, because she's been out for 4 days and understands it all. But in a sense, although I make light of it, I so believe that what we are doing is attractive to people because of this whole donor commercial challenge of how do you actually make an impact in a person's life through giving them dignity, by treating them with respect, or by giving them a meal? And the answer is that you want to try and facilitate that person to be able to earn their own meal. If you read the foreword the commendations in this book, the one that really tweaked my heart, if you like, was from the CEO of Christian Aid, who said, "This is a rallying call to all of us to strive for dignity, equality, and justice for all, and a challenge not just to teach a person how to fish, but to equip them to buy the pond."
Oh, yeah,
very good. And I thought when I read that, Stephanie wants to say something. Did you make that one up?
No, that's good. No, I just wanted to say, yes, I have been to visit Grant out there. A publisher has to really believe in the story that they're publishing. It takes a lot of work to publish a book. But there's also something called a libel law. You also have to know that it's actually true. And I also know Pete Portal, who this lady mentioned, who is working in Manenberg. And I went to see his work in Manenberg, and it is amazing. And I saw Pete after his book was published by Hodder. And he told me that he had, and I'd seen the manuscript at an early stage, and he told me that he had had to change detail after detail after detail because of the aforesaid libel law. You can't say this about that, but you can't describe this tattoo because it's identifiable. Well, we don't work like that. I just thought we have to get on a plane and go and see. And I went and had a look, and the stories that had just been on the page really came to life. When I saw the houses that Grant had built, lovely houses that anyone would want to live in, wide streets, hedges, the quality of them was just fantastic. I saw it with my own eyes, basically. When I saw the charity work, that was just so moving. I knew that this was safe territory. I knew that, I already knew that Grant was very much telling the truth, but it just needed to come alive. But I really was blown away. I hear a lot of people who say, I really want to make a difference with my life. I really want to do something with it that makes a difference. Mm. But you very rarely meet somebody who's actually done it, who's actually gone. And I was blown away by the sheer scale of the impact of what one man who's decided, right, he's going to actually put his money, and not only his money, but his time and his life, where his mouth is, and go and do it. And so I think it's an incredible story, so that's why we've published it.
Well, I think looking at time, we've time for one last question, and then I think we're going to be treated to a little bit of a reading, and then, of course, there's going to be an opportunity to buy the book and have it signed. I mean, that's why you're here. So, gentlemen.
Yes, I spoke to you earlier today regarding one of the major problems in East West Africa, basically the whole of Central Africa, is the fact that there is no local investment because people hold on to their money or move it abroad. You've set up a magical business there. What I'd like to know is, has it made any difference to the mindset of the businesses in Kenya? Because there's a lot of money in Kenya, as there is in all the other countries. It's just not invested, that's all. Do you think it's made any difference to the mindset out there?
Yes. But I think you can tell by my pause that it's limited. I think, first of all, you're completely right. It's wrong to think of either Africa or Kenya as there being no money. There is money there, there's a lot of money there. We do actually have a group of Kenyan investors who invest in our business. That's new. But they actually were challenged and inspired, not by me, but by Peter and Jero, my Kenyan business partner, because he led the way and invested money, and then challenged others to do the same thing. But that's a very limited group. To say, you know, it's catching on like wildfire would be a significant exaggeration. Obviously, I would love to see that grow. In addition to that, I'd love to see the income from the charity that we still run being funded by Kenyans, because that is the capacity is there. That isn't, you know, and in one sense, I'd almost challenge British people not to give into the donor world, because it takes the responsibility away. I know that sounds a completely daft thing to say when I run a charity, and thankfully Sue's not here, who does run the charity. But you can see the point I'm making. And therefore, what we are attempting to do is, I suppose, almost to expose what is possible with the money that is there, with the investment that, as you rightly say, you know, goes outside of the country, or they buy up tranches of land and sell it for 3 or 4 times the price 10 years later, or whatever, and make far bigger returns in that way. But actually, the whole principle of we're equal. And a response. You know, there is a lot of, dare I say it, I'm not a Kenyan, so perhaps I shouldn't, but there's a lot of snobbery that takes place between the rich and the poor in Kenya. The guy I told you about that...
Not just in Kenya.
Who I said that my son had Christmas dinner with, he came and asked me, right when I first moved in, if he could borrow some money. It was £25 or something like that. I said to Peter, why did he come to me? I've only just moved in. He said, you're probably, out of 48 flats here, you're probably one of three that actually talks to. Mm-hmm. And some of them go to church.